Thank you for listening to the On Background podcast with Roberto Alejandro, available on iTunes and Google Play Music, and of course at onbackground.com, your place for news and discussions about hip-hop, poverty, and policy. I'm your host, Roberto Alejandro, and I'm joined today by Fury Young and Dr. Israel, the producers behind Die Jim Crow, an EP and upcoming LP project tackling the issue of mass incarceration and featuring incarcerated and formerly incarcerated artists. Thank you so much for joining me, guys. Fury, let me start with you. This is your brainchild. Speak a little bit about how you came up with this idea.
Sure. I came up with the idea on the way to community college about 3.5 years ago. I was reading the book The New Jim Crow and listening heavily to Pink Floyd and Roger Waters records like Amused to Death and The Wall and The Final Cut, and really loved the concept album format, have always loved the concept album format, whether it's Pink Floyd or, you know, Marvin Gaye style, Let's Get It On. And I was listening to that and on the train reading the book, and I just kind of had a lightning bolt moment where I said, why don't I do a project that actually features the voices of these people as opposed to hearing it secondhand through, you know, Michelle Alexander's legal scholarly background, which, you know, her book's great. She's amazing. But I wanted to actually hear it firsthand from the artist. And I think the reason it moved me so much is because although I am white and I've never been to prison, I've known a lot of people who are not those two things. And I just had a lot of firsthand experience. So that was the culmination, and 3.5 years later, here we are.
And then let me just ask you a little bit, if you could speak about your background in music, in art, that, you know, before you started this project.
Sure. It was a weird thing. You know, I really, really wanted to be a film director for almost all of my life. And I grew up without a TV, so for me, movies were always sacred. And when I became, you know, after high school, it was around the time when YouTube was really blowing up and movies started to feel a little less sacred and everyone was doing digital and it just seemed a little less important to me. And you had the internet and you could watch stuff on that, movies, full movies on the internet. It lost a little bit of that magic for me, and I started exploring other art mediums and writing a lot of poetry and starting to learn to play the guitar. Music was always something that I saw as a huge part of the movies that I wanted to make. So I think Die Jim Crow actually has a lot of that influence. It's very cinematic, and the LP will be even more so. Currently, I have a book of poetry coming out September 17th, the 5-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street.
Okay.
It's called Meat and Milk. It will be out on Lit Riot Press. And I also, when I have the time, work on my own music, but that's been very scarce lately because of Die Jim Crow.
No, fair enough, fair enough. Dr. Israel, let me ask you if you could speak a little bit about your background and then how you got involved with this project.
Yeah, I've been producing and performing music for a long time. I started as Dr. Israel in the late 90s.
Okay.
And I've worked with, I mean, I can't even count how many artists I've worked with. I worked with, you know, Buju Banton. I worked with Mad Professor, who's known very well in Europe. I don't know so much here. I worked with Rancid, Sepultura, a lot of different. I mean, that's just to name a few.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So I've had my own music career, and I got very interested in production and recording as part of that journey. So I do, you know, all three of those things. I'm an artist. I'm also a recording engineer and a producer. And Fury came to me, late 2014, and he was like, do you know anybody that would want to go record in a prison? I was like, yeah, I'd like to go record in a prison. And so I, you know, as we spoke about a little bit prior to the interview, I came on board, I think, initially from a technical standpoint to facilitate, you know, to get my head, to get have somebody get their head around how do you go inside of a prison, you know, a closed security prison, with all of the difficulties of actually getting equipment in there and limits to what you can and can't do. And, you know, from there, I started to realize I could play a role, because what Fury says is very true. He comes at things from a very, very cinematic standpoint and has a very clear understanding of what he wants But sometimes he's missing the and he's learning it very well and very quickly, missing the terminology, how to translate.
Sure,
that.
Yeah.
So like we spoke about a little bit earlier, you know, like I'll be able to say, well, you know, let's get a darker harmony happening there. Let's sing in falsetto. Let's try this. Let's try to phrase that more staccato. Try to do stuff like that. And you know, it was also a great challenge from the technical standpoint to actually get into a prison. And when we first talked about it, I was like, let's just approach this like an old Motown record, because you know we're not going to have a separate microphone for every instrument. We're not going to have great isolation for the vocals or for the drum booth. And the second time we went in, we actually managed to do that. But so that was how I got on board. And also, you know, I was extremely impressed with the groundwork that Fury had done. So you have a lot of people that will talk and say that they're, you know, anti-prison industrial complex activists, prison activists, however you want to phrase it. But, you know, I think a big piece that's missing is the voice of those who are in prison, the so-called incarcerated. And, you know, Fury came to the table with having these really intense relationships that he had forged with people who are caught up in the prison industrial complex. And when we went into the prison and started recording, I was super impressed by how much respect everybody had for Fury, because one of the biggest things is actually, you know, letting the voices be heard rather than just saying, okay, because, you know, throughout everybody that we've encountered in the prison industrial complex, everybody thinks there's something wrong with it, from the COs to the people who are locked up, to prison activists, to the activists who are working in the prisons. Like, everybody's like, this is wrong. This is not the way it should be. But I don't think everybody takes time to hear the voices of those who are most intensely affected.
Let me ask, I'll start with you, Fury. Is there anything that through the process of recording this EP and continuing the work to produce the full-length album, that you feel like you came in with certain assumptions about what prison was like, mass incarceration, all these phenomena, and that as a result of interacting with persons who were themselves incarcerated or formerly incarcerated, that you started to either change your mind about or you just got a different perspective on, you know? Was there anything like that as a result of this project for you?
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, over the years, you tend to forget some of those things, to be quite honest. So, you know, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, I definitely would have had probably a more realized way to explain it, or would have simply remembered. I think now I'm so ingrained in it, this is really like my life, that I don't think about that type of stuff as much, because I deal with people in prison daily, whether it's through JPay, which is a email type of service for people incarcerated, or through snail mail, or through phone calls. You know, I spoke to a woman in prison this morning, like an hour before we met, you know? So this is just a daily operation for me. I'm really just friendly and close with a lot of these artists, which is about 15 people across the country. One thing that I do remember is I thought that people who had done long periods in prison probably had similar characteristics before I really started talking to a lot of lifers. I thought that they'd probably be mostly, you know, bitter and frustrated and angry and kind of dark and intimidating. But that's really not the case. Everyone who I've met in this project, whether they've served life or serving life or did a life sentence and got out, because you can make paroles in some cases, some cases you can't. Everyone has had a unique personality and something super distinct about them, and completely not a stereotypical person in prison, or you could say a quote-unquote inmate, you know, so.
Let me ask you, Dr. Israel, if I can, because you're a professional musician, you've been in the industry a long time, and, you know, music is a lot about expression, allowing people to use their voice, and obviously this project is an attempt to speak about the issue of mass incarceration by hearing directly from the people who are most sort of directly affected by it. To your mind, is it possible to understand the humanity of the persons who are faced with incarceration if we don't hear their voice?
Well, I mean, I guess that is a difficult question and requires a lot of reflection. I think that if you're not able to, I mean, Fury talks about every individual is unique, and there tends to be an illusion that once you, and you know, society approaches it this way, once you are locked up, then following doing a prison stint, then these things are all true. You can't vote. You're on parole. You have to be extra careful about if you bounce a check, if you smoke ganja, if you do all these different things. But, you know, when you get at the individual, these people are all individuals. So I don't think that there's one specific broad truth that covers every individual that has an experience with the prison industrial complex. That being said, once you spend time with a cross-section really listening to people, you have a much better perspective of what it's really about. And you're able to see people for what they are. It's almost once you see some of the individuals as individuals, you're able to see all the individuals and the complexity as individuals. And I think that's a big piece. I mean, you know, we've done a lot of interviews, and one thing that I tend to say in the interview, people tend to ask, they tend to leave the interviews at some point, well, you know, what can we do? And I think there's a lot of things that can be done, but one of the main things is if you can interact with people who are experiencing the prison industrial complex on a one-on-one basis, you're going to understand. And that doesn't even have to be somebody who's incarcerated. That could be a kid of someone who's incarcerated. That could be the family members of an individual who's incarcerated. You know, there's a lot of ways to participate in the experience.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about the way the prison system really does have tentacles that extend well beyond just the persons who are in the prison or working in the prison, and that, I mean, you know, right, the effect is spread out.
You can talk about it all day, and I would say the easiest analogy I can say is if you look at the experience of slavery in the Americas, it's very similar tentacles. Because you have entire communities that are infected. You have entire economic spectrums that are influenced by this. You have, in general, there are no long-term incarceration facilities in Brooklyn. There are, but there's not on the level where you have. There's no prisons. Mm. So, I mean, you have people that have been, you know, locked up in the immigration
spot
for like 15 years. There's tons of jails. You have people that spend a lot of time on Rikers Island, a lot longer than they should be spending.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you don't really have a situation where you don't have the new prison that's been built in Brownsville, and now everybody's going to be able to work there. And you don't have a situation where someone who has a parent who's incarcerated is going to be able to hop on public transportation, be able to visit that family member, whoever that might be, with a 15-minute trip. So, you know, you've got the physicalities of it, you've got the economic elements of it, and then you have, in terms of, you know, one of the most intense things is that as you remove people from the community and remove them, their interaction with the community, you have, you know, what I've heard people talk about a lot is you have sort of a back and forth separation. The individual who is removed from the community and is imprisoned is out of touch with that community and is not talking to their kid about, you know, what's going on at school. And then you have sort of the anger in the community that individual is gone. And a lot of the blame does not fall on the system. Whereas a lot of the blame should be falling on the system, I think. You know, and it's complex. You have people who are not functioning well in society.
Sure,
and
yeah.
There needs to be a solution.
When you say that the blame is on the system, do you mean by the persons themselves affected? Or do you mean a society at large doesn't focus enough on the system we've created?
Well, I think both. And okay. I think that, you know, I've been aware of the prison industrial complex initially through relatives, but, you know, for most of my adult life. And the conversation has clearly shifted a lot, much like the shift that's happened with the Black Lives Matter movement, where, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, people got killed by the cops. That was just what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no conversation about, I mean, there was a general idea in the neighborhood that you didn't trust cops, but you weren't thinking about bringing that to a higher political form or a higher level of interaction with the media. You know, and I think now there's a conversation, which is great, where people, I mean, I was really struck because Fury, we went into Warren one time, Fury was speaking to a CEO while we were getting ready to go through security, And Fury knew an individual who the CEO grew up with. Mm. And Fury and this guy got into a very honest, very, like, you know, very honest conversation. The guy was saying, like, yeah, that was the guy in the neighborhood. Like, he was like, that was the guy who was going to make it. And that was the guy we looked up to. And Fury was like, well, what happened? And the CEO was like, I don't know. Mm. You know.
Let me ask you, Fury, just going back, focusing on the EP and the album, speak a little bit about the musical influences that are involved in this project.
Yeah, I think I spoke a minute before about The Wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall. That's a huge influence. You know, it starts off with childhood, and then it goes into, in the case of The Wall, it goes into Roger Waters, who's like basically the protagonist, becoming this famous rock star, and the traumas of his past come to haunt him, and he decides that he wants to build a wall to hide himself from his audience, his fans. Die Jim Crow, it's similar in the sense that it starts with childhood and the traumas of childhood, whether it's, you know, the big homie in the neighborhood who was like selling the drugs, and then you looked up to him and he got locked up, and then, you know, you got locked up with him, or that's a common story you hear. And then eventually this is where it diverges from The Wall, but, you know, you get caught up in the system and you get physically put in prison, as opposed to Roger Waters' metaphorical wall. And then the last act three, so act one, pre-prison, act two, prison, act three is reentry. And the thing is that in the reentry part of the record, those traumas don't go away, right? So it's like you do the time, but then you get out, and like Doc was saying, you can't vote, you can't get housing, you can't get a job, you can't see your kids, you're on parole, blah, blah, blah. Your jacket walks around with you, and if you get hit with some minor thing, you're doing, what, 10 years now? So the whole mania that you feel in The Wall, as the, you know, his wall is being built and the trauma gets heavier and heavier, you're going to feel that with Die Jim Crow. Other things that Roger Waters has done, like Amused to Death is a good album. Other concept records, like, you know, I talked also about Marvin Gaye. That's not so much a storyline concept with Let's Get It On or What's Going On. But the music in itself, really, it has refrains. You know, that's something me and Doc talk about a lot, is, well, like, for the LP, how do we take those musical refrains and revisit them throughout the record? So you hear, okay, that's the dark theme, that's the happy theme, or something like that.
I feel like we don't always get to have conversations about how we structure an album or a project like this. I'm wondering if you guys, you know, for those of us who aren't musicians and aren't artists, and, you know, we just press play and enjoy it, speak a little bit about that process, how you sort of map out an album, you know, into acts or into, you know, making, weaving those themes in and out. Speak a little bit about that process.
Sure, I can start. The whole album for me started as interviewing people. So I spent probably about a year and a half just talking to people who had been to prison or were in prison. And that allowed me to form a basic sort of outline of all the tracks. And that's still a work in progress, you know, but I do have pretty much about 30 little one sentence outlines of each song. So that's 30 songs, but the album will probably be about 26, which is how long The Wall is as well. But about 13 songs per disc, and some songs will be a lot shorter than others. So some songs will just be like a minute and they'll be instrumental. But that was compiled through just tons and tons of interviews. And I'm talking about with people who weren't musicians, who weren't writers, just everyday folk who had been to prison. Some of these were formal. Some of these were just people I ran into at Chinese takeout joints and started chatting with them, and it turned out they had been to prison. Next thing you know, they're telling me this crazy story about being in the cell next to the Son of Sam. You know? It's just all over the gamut. And the way that we've kind of turned that into a musical thing is that, I mean, first I started sending out that outline to people locked up or formerly incarcerated, and it's saying, well, what song do you want to do? And then they would come back with an idea. And then for the case of Warren Correctional Institution, they did all the music there. And when we went there, they recorded it. And for some of the songs of formerly incarcerated artists, we used their tracks, and they recorded vocals over the tracks recorded in the prison. And then other things, you know, are just on the spot. Like for Bitter Faces / First Impressions, that was a thing that I came up with on my guitar, just hanging out with Cedric Johnson in a motel 5 days after he got out of prison in Wichita, Kansas. Mm. So we recorded that first as this soul bluesy thing called Bitter Faces. And then we took that same guitar loop and used it as a beat for First Impressions, which is on the EP. Bitter Faces might be on the LP, might not. So the music thing, it's been a journey. Me and Doc listened to The Wall start to finish. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think it's an interesting question because the first thing, how do you structure a record? The first answer in today's time is that you don't. You don't make a record. You make a single and you hope it's a hit.
Yeah.
So then if you start with that, then you say, okay, well, but how do you structure a record? What you end up doing is that you have to have a very intense story that's worth telling. You have to understand the arcs to it, and you have to understand how you can apply different types of music to create that storyline. Mm-hmm. Fury's really good at it because he comes from film. So Fury's not really making an album. He's making a film, but there's just no moving picture to it. And he's got a whole, you know, completely insane-looking piece of paper with all the acts drawn out. And it looks like, you know, something from hieroglyphics from the Babylonian age or something. But it's, you know, it's excellent. It's significant, and everything is popping in, really falling into place. And I think when we listened to The Wall, the one thing that I was thinking was that this is an individual's journey. One person journeys through stardom. I was like, you know, and this is something Fury had already done without realizing, I think, he had done it. But I was like, what you have here is you have this character, but this character is multifaceted. So you're taking the individual's journey through the prison industrial complex. And it's not just one face. It's almost like you combine that with like the idea of Star Wars, like, you know, the hero with 1,000 faces or whatever. So the beauty of it is, even though you have the individual experiences and they're very different, you as a listener can just plug right in and understand what this journey is. And you can plug in, you know, it's like when you read a book, everybody has a different vision of the person's face. We're still reading the same book. We're still having the same story.
Yeah.
That's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought that up, because for the LP, you're going to really feel that, you know. So a good example, Tired and Weary is on the EP. You guys can listen to that right now. But the song that's going to come before that is That Other Face. So that's Valerie Seeley, that's the woman I was just talking to on the phone. She is doing 19 to life for killing her abusive partner. So the song is about being in a domestic violence relationship and the tension of that mounting and mounting until this altercation they had where he was basically trying to kill her. She stabbed him. He died. She calls 911 right then. You're going to hear that phone call, and then that transitions to Tired and Weary, Anthony McKinney in prison, in the county jail. Waiting to be sentenced to go to prison. And then after Tired and Weary, you're in prison. And so you're taking all these stories and combining them into one narrative.
You spoke a little bit earlier, Fury, about, you know, the way you might have the traumas of childhood impacting you into your life. You make certain decisions, you end up incarcerated. And then, you know, not only that incarceration continues to follow you, but those traumas as well. And, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about when it comes to issues of, say, I think especially criminal justice, you know, there's always this sort of debate about, is it driven by structural issues, you know, which is sort of speaks to the trauma of childhood and the things you experience, especially because I imagine a lot of these folks probably come from impoverished backgrounds.
All of them.
Yeah. And so, you know, so we talk a lot about the structural issues, and then there are those who want to bring up the trope of personal responsibility. And certainly for me, that has always felt like, you know, an attempt to not really deal with the issue. Right. But at the same time, I know that there are plenty of people in poor communities who also feel that personal responsibility plays a role, and, you know, different people to varying degrees. I'm curious whether in working with the artists, is there a position that has sort of emerged for yourself in terms of where that balance and that debate is?
Sure. It's interesting you say that, because there's actually a Reagan speech where he talks about, you know, the blame the society versus blame the victim. I think it was in, when did he originally run? 82? No, 80. 80. Yeah. So I think it was in 80. and he's talking about that. And, you know, the classic Republican thing is blame. Blame the victim. People say blame society all the time. I'm obviously more of someone who thinks, you know, the system is really fucked up and needs some major changes, and the world around you is what creates you, and the parents create you, you know, and the schooling creates you. So that's the system at large. But yeah, there's blame you can place on the individual, and I think that every individual does need to take responsibility for their own actions. I just think that a lot of times people are just simply dealt a really fucking horrible card, you know? I wasn't. The people I work with have been. So, you know, and even me as someone who wasn't dealt a horrible card, I deal with a lot of shit that's very challenging. So imagine someone who, you know, grew up completely impoverished in the shittiest neighborhood in Birmingham. And, you know, it's no surprise they wind up doing a life sentence for, you know, a felony murder charge, which is, if in case you don't know, it's like you were, this is Tamika Cole, by the way, you were in the scene of a crime when something happened and you didn't pull the trigger, but someone was killed and you got felony murder. So, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I mean, I think that that's, those are all great points. And I think that one thing that can't be overlooked, I guess, is very quickly, is that I believe in personal responsibility, but I don't agree with the disparity of the consequences. So, you know, it's like that guy who just got let off for rape, you know, and that was in the media, it was in California, I think. I don't remember where it happened, but, you know, basically this, an affluent guy committed a rape, and his parents went to
the judge.
The student.
Oh, yeah, I think it might have been Stanford. I can't remember. I don't remember. I remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess it was Stanford. And so basically what happened was, like, the parents went to the judge, and the mother made this plea saying, you know, well, my son's life is already ruined. And so he got off with, like, 6 months or something like that, 6 months of probation even. I'm not sure if he actually did time. So, you know, that's the stuff that's infuriating. And, you know, the thing is, at some point, it's going to have to match up. And there's also a different perspective on it. So something that you do growing up in the hood is not, in your cultural community, this is not frowned upon. It's frowned upon in the larger spectrum. You actually might be making the best economic choice that you can make at that given time. So until the structure is presenting realistic alternatives, you can't expect, I mean, people are not stupid. So you can't expect that guy to go to McDonald's and make minimum wage when he can be, you know, slinging on the corner and pulling down serious money. It's like society has to come up with some alternatives.
No, absolutely. Let me ask on the policy side of things, because I feel like as much attention as is paid to the criminal justice system nowadays, my experience, especially in the advocacy community, is that a lot of the energy is aimed at things like law enforcement reform. Which, while I agree it certainly has to happen, I also feel like as long as poverty looks like the way it does in this country, we're never going to be able to completely move away from a position where the community and the police are essentially at odds, because you have a department on one side that has to enforce laws and you have a community on the other that is either disenfranchised from meaningful participation within the structure created by those laws, and, you know, who often has no choice but to break those laws if they're going to eat that day or that week or that month. And I'm wondering if over the course of this project there have been ideas or conversations about potential ways to address this issue that nips it in the bud, right? That gets to the root or gets it before you end up in prison, right? Like, not we need reentry services. Like, yeah, that's, we do, but I would love to see something before someone ends up in prison.
Schools. Yeah. Oh, that is one thing. Here, why don't you talk about that, actually?
Yeah, I think two things about this project. I think the point of the musical element of the project is not to specifically address policy. I think that if we specifically address policy with this project, we violate what we're supposed to be doing. And we have a lot of conversations about, we have a lot of rules that we follow to not violate, almost like anthropological rules that we make sure we don't. I mean, that's a bad analogy, but we don't want to violate honestly hearing what people are saying. And if we come too much with our ideas, whatever they might be, we can violate that.
You're talking like literally musical things.
Literal musical rules that we have.
Like, there was a song.
sorry, real quick. Yeah, there was a song where it's like we had three formerly incarcerated women doing harmony vocals, and we had a vocal coach because they weren't super trained. And because the vocal coach was had such a great voice, we originally got her back in to do a bunch of fills on the harmonies, but then it just didn't work. And we were like, you know why it's not working? She doesn't have that same energy.
Yeah.
And we just need to stick with those three women.
Yeah, definitely. So we have a bunch of rules we've created that we definitely are following to make sure that this is an honest experience and that we don't make it say what we want it to say, that it says what the people who are the vocalist on it wanted to say. But one thing that, you know, we have done, and Fury set this up and I participated, and I think we're going to do a lot more of this, it looks like, is that, you know, we've done teach-ins in a middle school, and what that does is we're able to actually start a conversation with kids who are at an age before they're experiencing a lot of the prime time where they could go south, where they could get locked up. And it's been great. It's been really great. And I think that, you know, ultimately, I mean, again, I think it's that one-on-one interaction. I think, you know, with the youth, that's where you could really start effective change. And that's where you can, you know, a lot of it is people's core values. So Republicans will talk about core values and this and that. But a core value can be how you see yourself. And if you can get there and talk to a kid and you can convince that kid, the kid looks up to you and you say to the kid, you're a great kid. I like being around you. You're a nice guy, you're smart, or a nice girl, or a nice woman, whatever, you're smart, you're intelligent, then when that kid bumps into a cop and the cop is telling them something different, they know that that's not true. And when they're able to make decisions based on the fact that they know it's not true, they don't have anything to prove, they already know that they're a good kid. They know that they're smart. They know they're doing the right thing. I think that's a big piece of what, you know, what anybody can do to make a change.
Just to add to the thing he's saying about the school, that school was in Brownsville,
okay,
in the highest crime rate neighborhood in Brooklyn. Almost all the kids have a relative or, you know, mom or dad in prison. So that was huge. I mean, we had there was a girl who was crying, bawling in tears as she was talking to Mark Springer, who called in, who's from prison, called in from prison doing 28 years, you know, has done 28 years. So it was super emotional, you know, and I do think that we want to do more schools. I'm already talking to Ruby, the teacher, about doing another thing with them in the fall, that school. But I would love to go to every school of every artist on the EP where their kid is at and do a thing. You know, I'm already talking to Charles about it. When next time we're in Ohio, do something in Cincinnati. He's from Elmhurst, which is the roughest part of Cincinnati, or one of them. And you know, doing something at his elementary school and having people hear Charles, you know, because the thing is, it's like, yeah, you consider that guy a fuck up, the guy in yearbooks, they say most likely to be president, most likely to succeed, whatever. Maybe people thought most likely to get locked up. Well, guess what? He got locked up. But look what he's doing now. He's not a failure. Just because he's in prison, he's doing amazing things. And he has completely turned his life around. He already pretty much, in case the mic didn't pick that up.
He's an internationally released recording artist.
So, boom. And then, you know, to talk just about the original part of your question, I don't want Dijon Crow to be, like I said, hyperbolic, pedantic, or condescending, and, you know, forcing you what to think. I think as a work of art, at least the work of arts I like, it needs to be abstract in a way. It needs to let the listener come to their own fucking conclusion, you know, because this is complex shit. And, you know, the most overt anti-racist, anti-system, anti-prison thing about the album is the title, Die Jim Crow. And that's, you know, that's kind of like me and Doc's thesis. That was my thesis when I came up with the title, because that's my opinion. However, the rest of the album is mostly just telling it like it is as you lived it for these artists. So I don't want to shove anything down anyone's throat. Now, do I want these songs to have policy change? It would be great if they did. Am I a prison abolitionist? I don't even know, man. Like, I'm just down for the ride. I'm down to see what happens. I don't have the big answers. But I do think, you know, there are 80,000 people in solitary confinement. There's going to be two songs on the record about being in the SHU. And, I, like, those songs are going to be the most fucked up songs hopefully ever recorded. so people can hear that in the ivory towers and say, you know, maybe they'll get moved by it a little bit. Maybe that, maybe it will push a lot of change. I don't know, but it's just step by step. And I think part of that step so far, even prior to putting out the EP, has been going to these schools and talking to the youth.
Let me ask, you know, we talked a little bit about album structure and that process of determining that. And I don't know if this is a question that's specific to concept albums like this necessarily, but I'm curious, as the artist creating, not exclusively, but the one sort of, you know, masterminding the whole project, is there a way you feel like people should consume this album? Is it the sort of thing you should press play and listen to through the whole way through?
Yes.
Yes, I mean, this is, I mean, we said that about the EP, and luckily, you know, the EP, we're getting ready to do a bigger push of it. Our initial offering, the initial release was primarily to, you know, our core fan base, which is, you know, some very, very excited Kickstarter backers. And, you know, a big part of what Fury was saying is like, you know, this is a great thing if you have a 25 minute drive. You know, get in your car and put this on, listen to it beginning to end. This is one of the things, this is one of the records that still is very important to follow this thing beginning to end. And we have a lot of conversations about how do we get that out there to people that you need to listen to this whole thing, because people are not in the habit of doing that. So
one track. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I actually have the Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted album as like a single MP3 that's like, you know, an hour and 20 minutes nice. Long. No, it's it has an incredible moment on it, you know, where he's talking about the way politicians talk about black people need to end violence, you know, black on black crime. And then, you know, it ends with, you know, how police will arrest you and break your neck. And it was crazy listening to that in the aftermath of Freddie Gray and everything that happened in Baltimore, and to think, you know, I think that album is, I can't remember if it's 89 or 91. It's somewhere in that range. But, you know, that's 25 years
that's
ago.
Probably 91.
Yeah, I think
or 92
that's right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So, but
it's,
you know,
after they broke up.
No, so. That's right. But, you know, that's 25 years ago. And Freddie Gray, you know, happened a year. You know, that should be impossible, right? Like, we should have heard that 25 years ago and not let things subsist to the point where this could happen exactly what he describes 25 years later. Now,
I totally agree with that. I think what I see is that the what's changing, and this is interesting, I see the similar thing with the conversations about the prison industrial complex. What's changing is not the reality. Mm-hmm. What's changing is that for whatever reason, mainstream society is now ready to have these conversations. For whatever reason. And the media is ready to have these conversations. I don't know specifically why, but
let me ask on the media side, because obviously that's the realm that I occupy. And like you said, this project is about highlighting voices in this debate that we never really hear from, right? You know, I think occasionally we hear from folks who are like formerly incarcerated, now they're working in a nonprofit on these issues, right? But that's not, how do you interpret the media's role in our lack of familiarity with voices like this?
A lot of the media is owned by powerful white men, you know, rich white guys who have never walked a day in Compton or Brownsville or Elmhurst.
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree with that. I would say that, you know, up until now, and I think, you know, this record is going to be a great part of the beginning of these voices being heard. You see people who are locked up, and they exist in a certain place in sort of propagating the status quo. So you see people who look scary. You see people who are in handcuffs. You see people where other people are talking about what they did and how horrible it is. But you don't really get to see or hear these people who are shot into the prison industrial complex talk about what happened. It's just, I mean, and there's been a lot of conversations that we've had in interviews where, you know, a lot of people, we did an interview with On the Count, which is a great show. And the two brothers that were there were basically talking about, they've both done significant time, and they were talking about, you know, hey, it's interesting that you're doing this, because when you're locked up, people forget about you. You know, society forgets about you. Your family forgets about you. Your community forgets about you. And, you know, Mark Springer had called in and without even hearing what they had said, said the exact same thing. He said, I'm so thankful to Fury Young for including me in this because he's like, I thought everyone had forgotten about me. And this is a man who's 28 plus years into his stint, into a life sentence, serving three life sentences for one murder, which I can't figure out how that works, but...
Yeah, the vagaries of our criminal justice system. You've given me a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. I just want to speak a little bit about Revolution Sound in a moment. I wanted to ask first if we could just speak a little bit about the genres involved in the album, the different musical genres that folks will hear.
Yeah, the genres are, at least on paper, traditionally African-American music, so everything from jazz to R&B to rock and roll to hip-hop. But then, you know, to break that mold, I think there needs to be some stuff that's just totally left field because it's interesting. And I, you know, as the producer, I also just enjoy that. I think, you know, breaking ground, breaking stereotypes of what you think. Oh, album, like, you're going to get me riled up. But yeah, like an album with black people in prison, it's going to be hip hop. I remember I was doing street outreach and I was in Washington Square Park and I talked to this guy and his girlfriend sitting on a bench and maybe he was just trying to impress her and be a dick, but I was trying to raise money for the Kickstarter and I was handing out a bunch of flyers and I was like, it's, you know, this is an album about racism in the U.S. prison system written and performed by formerly and currently incarcerated black musicians from across the country. And he was like, oh, so it's going to be like Lil Wayne? And I was like, no, like, you fucking asshole, actually, blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, oh, so it's going to be like Kanye? Oh, and then I just walked away because I was about to hit the dude, yeah. You know? And that wouldn't have looked good for the next person I handed a flyer to.
No, that's true.
So, but it's going to break the mold is what I'm trying to say. And there will be a song, the dream sequence song of someone incarcerated having this dream, which the lyrics are a poem by Spoon Jackson. It will transition from this sort of ethereal kind of sound to actually African music recorded, hopefully in Africa. We would love to go to Africa and record it. There's an East African musician out of Zimbabwe by the name of Thomas Mapfumo, who's freaking brilliant. And that's a big musical reference for me for that sequence on the album. So,
excellent. And then the EP, as I understand. Oh, did you want to? Absolutely.
I wanted to add, you know, one thing. It's funny because I hear Fury saying, you know, traditionally African American styles of music, and I'm sitting there, I was like, is there other kinds of music?
Not in America. Well, bluegrass maybe. I mean, there's a few.
Absolutely.
Influence there as well.
So, no, absolutely, so. Absolutely. You know, in a lot of ways, obviously, these all, and we talked a little bit about this offline before we started, these are all sort of sounds from the African diaspora, right?
Right. Well, I think the idea is that, and I think it happened, Fury has a very specific, very broad and also specific vision that he came to the record with, but it's happening very organically. Things are happening very, very organically. So there hasn't, when we were recording, it's also, you know, recording in the prison is intense. And there's not a whole lot of time. So we had 2 days the first time. We had 4 days the second time. Four sessions. The second time we went in, and actually, you know, Fury built a drum booth, and we put together a vocal ISO room. And, you know, I'm, like, running around with my eyes crossed trying to run cables and set up microphones and all this stuff. So you don't have a lot of time. So there's not a lot of time to really sit down and say, you know, well, hey, guys, let's do this. Let's do the other thing. And the way that we do the pre-production is they'll record stuff or they'll go over things in prison. We can't be there. And so Fury will get to hear a little bit of this, a little bit of that over the phone, you know, if it's working. And also with JPay, you know, I don't know if I mentioned, but I heard that Bloomberg called it the Apple of the prison industrial complex.
Oh, okay.
So that's JPay is another interesting thing to think about in this whole journey. But it's happened very organically. So this is the music that is being grown out of prisons.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how...
Like an ethnography in that way.
Yeah.
Have the prisons that you've worked with been fairly cooperative in terms of allowing you to come and set up, or...
That's definitely a me question. Because I deal with this. It's horrible. That is, no, not at all. They've been so not receptive. Warren Correctional Institution is like this total fluke. It's crazy that it even happened. And I've been denied from like 7 other places, maybe more than that. And
that's part of the purpose of the EP. You should.
Yeah, and you know, I am hoping that people who hear the EP say, wow, this music is freaking amazing. I really would love to get them access to another prison. So if you are listening and you know, you have a connection to a prison in Baltimore or in Maryland, I should say, there probably aren't any prisons in Baltimore proper, but
there's a large
aside from
jail,
every project.
In Jessup, we have
so stuff like that. Yeah, we're trying to make it a calling card. Yeah, definitely. We got to record in a woman's prison. I mean, I don't even think I would release the LP if there's not at least one session from a women's prison and one more from a men's prison. Hopefully, if it was up to me and I had to pick a place, it would be the South for the men's prison, and the women's prison, fucking anywhere. I don't care. Just let me in.
And then I wanted to ask you, Doc, the EP and eventually the LP is being released through your company, Revolution Sound. I'm going to say company now because it's not just the label. So I wanted you to speak a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, Revolution, part of today we're speaking about a specific project. Mm. But the reason that this specific project is happening is that I think there's a bigger community that's happening surrounding the recording studio upstairs and Fury's effort and, you know, his artwork and other music that I'm doing. So I have, you know, we have an art space upstairs and it's called Central Arts and Recording. And the wing of it that is the label wing or the music wing is called Revolution Sound. And really what it is it's designed to be sort of a tactical resource group for artists. So we're working with artists a lot of different ways. You know, if artists need help, understanding what social media is, or if they need help understanding what distribution is, or if they need help, I mean, someone can bring me a contract that someone's offered them. I can read it for them. I can check it out. I've done deal memos for people. And so it just turned out that time, and this has been a vision for a long time, it turned out that timing wise, Fury brought this project, brought me to this project, and then I brought the idea of doing the release, you know, through the company Revolution Sound, and he thought it was a great idea, and we thought it was a great idea, and we'll be building a lot of projects over the course of the next, you know, next couple of years. We're working on a digital distribution deal right now, but the idea is to create a place where the weight of the music is the value of the company, you know, rather than to create a place where we're doing. I mean, if we have something that's a commercial hit, I'm not going to argue about
it. Sure, yeah.
But it's not the goal. It's not the goal. Mm. The goal is to actually, you know, create a sustainable environment for people to continue creating music in.
And then let me just ask, for those who want to get the EP, where do they find it?
The EP is very soon will be available everywhere. Right now, you won't go wrong if you go to diejimcrow.com. And you can navigate through the website there. You can get it through the website. You can get it through Bandcamp there. That's great. I think in the course of about, at some point in September, we don't know the exact date yet, it'll be available everywhere. So okay. Amazon, iTunes, wherever you like to buy your digital music from, go there. It's available for, you know, you can stream it on SoundCloud. You can go to diejimcrow.com and you can help support the effort. All help is extremely appreciated. And in addition, what's extremely helpful is to have anybody that's excited about this project go spend some time at the website, listen to the music, email Fury because he'll write you back.
Okay.
And he writes everybody. I've seen it. He writes everybody back. And if you can share it, because we need help curating this. That's
absolutely
a big thing.
Yeah.
So if it's something that, you know, if just spend some time with the project, if it's something that you feel is important, share it with at least 2 or 3 of your friends and tell them to do the same. We could really, it's really helpful. It's a grassroots thing.
Definitely. And you can also get the book too. The book is a big part of the EP release. So it looks so good. The EP book started off as something that we were going to do as like a DIY zine. We were going to have it be a Kickstarter reward. And I thought, well, you know, it will be about 50 pages. It will have the lyrics and stuff and maybe a few pieces of art. Then, you know, we ended up getting this book deal for it through Two Leaf Press, and we put out a 184-page full-color book, which is super thorough. You'll check it out when you get home.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm looking
and
forward to it.
And it comes with a free download. If you look, open the first page, there's a free download code via diegymcrow.com. So that's another big part of the release, and I encourage people to buy the book. That's another thing where it's currently linked through Amazon.com, but we may have a direct link to get it through me, through the website. But either way, you can still find it on just the website, diegymcrow.com. Yeah, everything. Everything you need.
Excellent.
We even sell diapers.
Nice. Definitely buy your diapers at diegymcrow.com and get the EP, Die Jim Crow. Fury Young, Dr. Israel, the minds behind Die Jim Crow, thank you so much for the time you've given me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.